This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with a rejuvenating radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Can you feel it? Greens? Can you feel it all the way there?
No. Oh, yes.
We can feel it all the way on the moors.
I can feel it up in the moors of Scotland and the moors of Glasgow.
This is...
There are no moors here.
This is Ben Stone on the Freedom Fiends. I'm sitting in for Michael temporarily. And with me are the Greens. Go ahead and introduce yourself, Dan.
Well, yes, I'm Dan Green.
I'm Katie Green, and we do the Greening Out podcast together.
Yeah, as far as we know, we're the only libertarian, anarcho-capitalist-based podcast in Scotland.
Scotland, as far as we know, but we always welcome people to challenge that and come to us and go, no.
We'd be happy to work together.
I had it first. But we haven't had anybody do that yet, so until anybody does, we are going to keep claiming to be the only one of our kind around these parts.
And I should mention the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BitCot no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more about that at bitcot.org, BITCOT.ORG. What's your website if people want to find you on the internet?
Yeah, it's greeningoutpodcast.co.uk.
If you go to .com right now, you might see nothing because our domain name is expired. So, haha. So you'll have to go to the .co.uk for now. We're getting that sorted.
So before we started, I was going to make an obscure reference to a single episode of Monty Python that I warned the Greens ahead of time that there's probably only like 10 or 15 people in the whole world who even know about it. But... But anybody who wants to look it up, you can look up Arthur Two-Sheds Jackson, and it's a pretty funny little Monty Python skit. But like I say, there's very few people who are going to get that because it's such an obscure reference. I also warned the Greens ahead of time that I am under, where I'm at here in southern Alabama along the Gulf Coast, I'm under a tornado warning, so... at any particular time, my mic might go dead, but the recording will continue because, you know, that's the kind of dedication we have here on the Freedom Fiends. And Katie and Dan will take over and keep talking for me. If that does happen.
Oh, yes.
We'll do our best.
That sounds really, really scary, man, because, like, Dan and I were just talking there, and basically a tornado is one of those things. I dream about them quite frequently. I've never seen one. I've never...
You have natural disaster dreams?
Yeah, I have a lot of them. No, I don't know what it is. Natural disaster films are very comforting to me. I like to watch them. Films like Twister.
Oh, yeah. Bill Pullman was in that. That was like a 90s movie.
I enjoyed that film, sir. That had Helen Hunt in it, too.
We went on the Twister ride at Universal Studios in Florida.
Yeah, they do a ride at Universal Studios, the Twister experience. It's really, really good. But no, I'm not belittling anybody's experience, though, in a tornado. And I don't imagine it's anything like the film. I don't think it's any fun.
I think Helen Hunt was in that film as well.
I don't think Helen Hunt turns up.
Did I get that wrong?
And charms you. I don't think that happens. But things like tornadoes, natural disasters, they really, really frighten the life out of me. I don't know what other word to use. They really, really scare me. When I was a little girl, I used to fear them. I grew up in Vancouver, Canada. We never had a tornado. We had a couple of earthquakes, but that was about it. But
I blame the Wizard of Oz.
Do you blame the Wizard of Oz for my fear of all things unnatural? I know, but it is quite scary.
I don't have any fear of, that's kind of weird. I grew up on the West Coast, and mostly in California, and I've lived in Nevada and Kentucky and Ohio, and now we're kind of traveling around in our RV. And when I mention California, a lot of people say, how could you tolerate the earthquakes? Didn't that frighten you? And it never, earthquakes never frightened me. I was in Kalinga, California, 1966. We had a really bad earthquake that leveled quite a few buildings. Part of the streets, like the business that my dad ran, the street in front of his business was damaged pretty severely, along with buildings and so forth. And I remember that like it was yesterday. We were in a very old house that was built by the railroad in the 1800s when the earthquake hit. And it was just my grandmother was there and myself. And when the earthquake hit, I remember standing up. And it was the first big earthquake my grandmother had ever experienced. She was from Appalachia. And she was quite worried. And, you know, I'm like 5 years old. I stood up. I said, we called her Mamaw, you know, Appalachian lingo. And I said, come on, Mamaw, we're supposed to stand in the doorway. So we walked over to the doorway. And we stood in the doorway and watched outside. And the earth shook to the point of where trees and telephone poles were like bending from the waves hitting. And I remember thinking, wow, this is really cool. But I never had any fear of it. And I always kind of thought, things like that, we have absolutely no control over. Hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, volcanoes. And I never really had any fear of them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good point, is they're natural things. And you can't, we can build, you know, river dams and stuff to stop from flooding damage, but we can't actually stop these things. I think that's probably why I'm so scared of them.
Do you know what my mum used to always say to me about, like, growing up in Scotland? Like, we'd have, like, periods when, you know, it's consistently raining, like, it rains every day for what seems like months
but
sometimes.
You don't have any extremes.
You know, yeah, and we get stuff like that, and then in the winter it gets incredibly dark all the time, and it stays dark for most of, like, the day.
But the worst it gets.
Then that's what she says, that's the worst that happens. She said, you know, in some places they have hurricanes and tornadoes and tidal waves and volcanoes and all the rest of it, and that's the worst you've got to deal with, is, you know, having to go out in the rain every day. You know, so she was always a be thankful sort of person in that respect.
She is, she really is. But it's true though, these things, tornadoes, hurricanes, they are quite scary. I think that's why I was probably so afraid of it. It's unstoppable. You can't stop a tornado, you know, once it's there.
It give you a helpless feeling.
I think that's probably why. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of strange. I hadn't really thought about it, but your description of Scotland in the wintertime, you know, I've done a little bit of, not a lot, I've done a little bit of studying on Nordic religion and Scandinavian religions, and they have this overbearing threat of the return of the ice sheets, you know, of the ice giants coming down from the north and endless winter. And that was like an enduring fear among Scandinavian people that the ice giants would return. And that's the way they saw the end of the world happening. The ice giants would return, kill the gods, and there would be like this massive battle at the end where the gods and the ice giants all did battle, and the ice giants would kill the gods. And then there would be a very small remnant of humanity that would somehow, you know, escape and come back and repopulate the earth once all the ice giants and the gods were dead. And, you know, I think living in a place like that where every winter seems endless. We used to live in Ohio, and the Ohio winters kind of seem endless. And I could always imagine how easy it would be to have a theology like that, where you just thought, you know, someday this winter is just not going to end. It's just going to go on and on and on.
That's what this winter felt like. This winter did go on and on and on.
Definitely, yeah, I suppose, yeah. But then you could also think of, like, a nuclear winter would go on and on and on. And there's also, like, you know, like the prospect of an ice age is something that...
Well, that is scary because...
I mean, I've heard some theories that, like, sort of things like astrology came about because there was, like, some, like, huge disaster. And then because the people were scared, it was something to do with the stars. I've heard this theory from a few different places that it was because it was something to do with the stars. That's how astrology developed, because they were, like, really terrified by you know, what the stars might do next, because maybe say 10% of people actually survived. Because, you know, you get the biblical flood myth, but you also find it in lots of other stories from other cultures. You find the same flood myth. So, like, some people think that there was this real disaster that maybe wiped out almost maybe even 90% of people. It's could really, be true,
but
I don't know.
Ben, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Are those hailstones
out here? I hear a natural disaster. I hear a flood.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. We've just been talking about disasters, and you're sitting in this, you know, it can't be helping. I apologize.
I'm in a tin can and getting buffeted by Gulf storms that come through. They are pretty bad down here sometimes. The Gulf region, I brag about this a lot. You know, well, I don't know if that's the right terminology, but I really, we came down here a couple of years ago for the first time into the Deep South. I've been, you know, along the borderline of the South in the United States. I've been all over Texas and, you know, Oklahoma, Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia. I've been through all that area on and off my whole life. But a couple of years ago when we went full-time RVing and we got in the motorhome and just tried to go as far south as possible and get out of the nasty winters of Ohio. We came down here almost by accident to the Alabama coast. It was just the straightest line that we could get to, you know, to the Gulf of Mexico. And we got down here into the Mobile Bay area. And what a revelation. It was just like, how did we not know this place existed? First off, it's beautiful. Most of the time, the weather is great. When the weather is not great, it's trying to kill you. But all the other time, you know, it's really nice. There are alligators. You have to watch out. Like, we have a little dog with us in our RV. And so she has to go out, and we have to walk her several times a day. And we really have to watch out because there are alligators that can kind of jump out of nowhere at any particular time. And to them, a little dog like that is really, you know, oh, look, a tasty little treat. I'll just take one bite.
Chump. I know.
We also have wild boar, which are the danger with wild boar in the South. First off, you know, they're huge. They're like the size of a bear. Mm. And they have an unending appetite. And they have very little. They don't intentionally show their presence to humanity. They're mostly nocturnal. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they have no real fear of humans, like a deer does, because they're actually pretty smart. Well, anyway, so now I talked us into our break. Folks, stick with us. We're gonna head out to the market, and we're gonna come right back with more Freedom Fiends on the radio.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN or virtual private network from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Ben Stone with Katie and Dan Green on the radio. I'm in a storm. That's if you can hear the rain in the background. And we're talking about nonsensical items like regional animals and whatnot. So, Katie, tell us. During the break, we were talking about foxes. We have foxes here, but you never see them. But you said they're more like raccoons there in Scotland.
Well, here, like they remind me of the raccoons when I was little growing up in like the west coast of Canada. We had a lot of raccoons, but here it's foxes, and they hang out sort of at nighttime. Obviously, they only come out when it's dark. So they are very, very nocturnal animals as well. But they've become quite cocky the last few years. They don't just like they used to hide in holes, but now they're really out and about and. Dan, you were out with the dog recently.
Well, I've always seen them about here, and like my mum used to say to me, like, just don't corner one and you'll be fine. And that used to be the case. Like, as soon as a fox saw you, it would run away. But like, our dog is a Jack Russell Terrier, so they were traditionally used in fox hunting because the idea with them was they were small enough to get down a hole with a fox, but tough enough to deal with them when they got there. But now, like, I remember there was one evening I was out walking Barney, and this fox, for some reason, it kind of stopped and looked at us, and then it crossed the road, and then it started walking up behind us quite quickly, like, towards us, but it was looking at Barney, but not at me for some reason.
Yeah.
And I just turned around, and I just started making mad Scottish noise, like, hey, yeah, I see you, yeah, I'll go yeah, get to you. Yeah.
So, and then the fox just runs away, so...
That might be one of the funniest things I've heard lately. Mad Scottish noises.
just Scottish noises. You go, are you? Yeah. And you just call them all sorts of names and they run away. It works with foxes. It works with people. It works with a lot of things.
Too bad it didn't work with the English. Dog,
yeah, well. Yeah. But our dog, he's a Jack Russell Terrier, but he's like so domesticated and spoiled, he wouldn't know what to do. Like, he's so spoiled, really.
You know, I'm thinking of Scottish clans in the ancient days and so forth, and I'm thinking the fox probably looked at that Jack Russell Terrier and said, my great-great-grandfather was bitten by one of you. You'll never
be
free.
They just hate each other.
Guys, see, that was one of the better American attempts at a Scottish accent that I've heard.
I know. I've heard many, many in my life, yeah.
I am Appalachian, and we Appalachian folk are, you know, we're called hillbillies for a reason, and the reason why is because we were from Scotland, and we sided with the wrong side in the English Revolution. We took the side of William. William and his wife, and in doing so, they derogatorily referred to us as hillbillies, and we were driven out of Scotland. Some of them ended up, going into Northern Ireland and becoming what are commonly referred to as what's that name they call us anyway? But a lot of us, you know, us. Not me. I was not born yet, but a lot of my ancestors left. They couldn't live in Scotland. They were kicked out. They couldn't live in England. They were hated there. And so they came to the New World in the mid-1600s. Mm. And they were hated by the colonists, too, because, you know, they were dirty Scotsmen and dirty Irish from Northern Ireland. Ulster Scots, that's what, because of Ulster. And so they were hated by the colonists. They, you know, they were the high-minded type of people who could that didn't make good servants. So they would sign on as bond servants in order to get a free ride across the ocean in ships. And then they would get over here, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't take orders. And so the colonists hated them. They didn't make good bond servants. They wouldn't take orders. They wouldn't live, as a slave like they were supposed to. And so they ended mm-hmm. up migrating off into the Appalachians, where even the Native American Indians didn't really want the land because it's, you know, high and rocky up in the tops of the Appalachian Mountains. And they got up in there, mm-hmm. these Scotch-Irish, as they're referred to, and they got up in the mountains of Appalachia, and they were like, hey, we're home. There's no government. There's no English. There's no rules. We can live in our clans. We can set our own rules. And we can, we can do our own marriages, our own divorces, our own funerals. We don't have to pay taxes. And Appalachia is kind of like Scotland, kind of like heaven. And then the government moved in and ruined everything.
Wow. No, they have a habit of doing that, unfortunately.
Well, I actually watched the series of that show Moonshiners, and it's about people that made moonshine and stuff. And is that not basically, from what I understand, it's like the American version of what was called poaching and like Ireland and stuff?
Interesting.
And in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to head out to the market again, and we'll be right back, folks. Stick with us.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Hey, this is Squiscar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Drink for the bottle. You're weird, Dan.
As the phrase goes, we're talking too much to be a talk radio show.
Too busy talking.
Yeah, that's it. I messed up the line.
I have too much to say.
So Dan was telling us about a youthful, wild story from his days gone by during the break.
In the Glasgow Moors. Yeah, tell us, Dan.
Well, I was a teenager, and like my family are all from Donegal, and so are my friends' families. So we used to sometimes all go over to Ireland and things. And we met these guys one time, and they had poutine, which is basically what I was saying before the break, kind of moonshine. As it's like a kind of, you know, homemade whiskey that's illegal in both, you know, Ireland, Scotland, and the US. And I tried some of this stuff, and it was so crazy. You know, I just remember it in like blurs, like. I don't know if anyone's ever seen that Smashing Pumpkins video for 33. It was made with all still photos that were run together.
Together. Yeah, they ran together.
And that's what that evening was like. It was like all still photos that were just running together for me. And then I woke up the next day and I kind of felt sort of all right. And I had this big, big glass of water because my mouth was so, so dry. And then I was drunk again. And I was like drunk again
for the next few hours. I don't think you went to the tap for water. That's not how water works.
No, seriously, I don't know if it like. I think it lies dormant in your system and then like the water awakens it again and then all of a sudden you're drunk for the next
few
hours.
I'm going to test your theory sometime. That's...
Oh, yeah.
I don't think anybody should try that at home at all.
No, please don't try that
please
at home.
Please don't try anything this man ever does, ever.
Drink yourself blind and then wake up the next morning and... Do it again with water.
Do it all again.
That's the thing. You could end up playing, which is the problem.
I come from a long line of moonshiners from Appalachia. One time, I have so many stories of Eastern Kentucky that it's more than radio can handle. But one time, before my dad died, my wife and I took my daughter and her boyfriend, and we went down to visit my father and some of my other family down there. And we were off in this, and one of my family's properties that's pretty remote, actually. And we were standing outside, and my dad said, you know, I think he said 1937 was the year of the story that he was telling. I think he said 1937, he came up this hollow. Of course, in Appalachian terms, that's a holler. He came up this hollow, and he pointed up at the mountains in front of us, and he said, you know, I went up on that ridge up there and something or other and something did this and that and bought a bunch of corn and then took it over. And then he described the making of sour mash, which is the precursor to actually making whiskey. And you find a spot in the ground where there's a lot of clay naturally in the earth. And you dig out a sump into this clay, and then you you smash the corn up as much. You leave it right on the cob, and you just smash the corn up as much as you can. Throw it down in there, and then cover it over with any kind of covering that you can have. It can be sticks, or it can be a board, or it can be, you know, a piece of tin or whatever. But you cover it over, and then you leave it. And it naturally ferments, you know, it catches mold out of the air and it's on the corn naturally and so forth. And it ferments, and as that mash ferments, it becomes sour mash. And then you scoop it all out of there and then you distill it. And so he's telling this whole story, you know, about doing this in 1937. And my daughter is standing there listening to him. You know, he was an old man, so everybody is listening. Everybody's quiet and listening to the old guy talk, like when I'm in the room. And I remember my daughter's boyfriend stood there looking at him with his mouth literally hanging open, like he was telling about walking on the moon or something. It was so far removed from this kid's mind that people actually did this. But he's like, yeah, that's what we did. And then, you know, then you sell the, once we got the moonshine made, then you take it to town and people give you money for it. And it was just like a common thing. It was so common in Appalachia that pretty much the only people who didn't make moonshine were the ones who were seriously religious. In a sense, like some of the Baptists don't believe that you should have anything to do with alcohol and so forth. So unless you were one of the specific religious groups that forbids alcohol, pretty much everybody made their own, you know, whiskey, and then took it to the towns and sold it. And that has been the way of Appalachia, you know, literally going into the 1600s. It's how they maintain their freedom and how they, you know, maintain themselves. Bought crops, bought seeds so they could have crops. Bought supplies for the winter. That's been the way in Appalachia for literally since the mid 1600s.
Yeah, I was actually, funnily enough, looking that up.
But you know,
Dan,
go ahead.
Oh no, sorry. I was just going to say, Dan, what did you look up? But Ben, if you were going to say something, it's probably more. It's probably interesting. So go.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm dominating too much of the conversation anyway.
No, I was like looking at it on Wikipedia, and it was, yeah, it said it's the white whiskey that entered the Appalachian region in the 17th to early 1800s, and it was the Scots-Irish immigrants from the Ulster region of Northern Ireland. So that's sort of where Donegal is. Where,
well, see, I think that's really interesting, kind of, though. I like that. I like the idea you can make your home brew. You know, you could make your homemade.
That's also why, like, country music sounds a bit like folk music here from here. Yeah, that's why it sounds a bit like that, because it's the same kind of people using the same kind of instruments.
But I mean, the whole thing about it, though, is the government, nobody should have a monopoly on something. It shouldn't be that people can't make something in their own home.
Let's make moonshine illegal. Let's make moonshine. Let's decriminalize
moonshine. Bring it back. No, I'm just saying it should be perfectly fine and acceptable for someone to make something natural in their home and then to either use it, consume it, or sell it.
Seeing that Moonshiners documentary,
very, very natural.
They were making out of everything. They were getting like bananas and making like brandy out of it. They could make like booze out of anything. These guys were like masters.
But people make it bad here. Like, one of the arguments some people use against sort of a free market, when I bring it up to them to do with alcohol, they go, oh, what? So you'll make some stuff in your bathtub, turn people blind? I go, well, I'll go to jail very, very quickly if I do that. Why would I do that? Yeah. It's not in my interest to make a quick $100 or whatever it is to go to kill someone and go to jail. That is so not in my interest. So, you know, I don't understand. It doesn't make sense in my brain why people aren't allowed to do this. It doesn't make... Dan, you're looking at me like I'm insane.
I agree.
You know, a lot of people don't understand this, though. There's real history behind this. I don't have the references in front of me, so I can't quote exactly what website you can go to. But during the prohibition of alcohol in the U.S. during the 1920s, the government, the U.S. government, and state governments like the state of New York, intentionally took alcohol, denatured it, which means literally to add poison to it, and then put it back into bootleg alcohol so that it would be sold on the streets in the black market. They intentionally poisoned the alcohol so that and people died from it, and they did that so that they could spread the rumor that, you know, homemade alcohol was bad, when in fact the government itself had intentionally poisoned the alcohol in order to get that rumor going. When you're brewing alcohol for human consumption, there's a temperature range where, as you bring the liquid up in temperature, at one range of temperature, drinking alcohol evaporates off of it, and you catch that evaporation, and then you run it through a series of coils to cool it back down and turn it back into its liquid form. And if you distill at a slightly higher temperature, actually it's about 15 degrees higher, then It turns into a poisonous version of alcohol, like rubbing alcohol, which actually will harm you. But people who do this on a regular basis know the temperature. I mean, it takes a thermometer, so it's not like, it's not like some. You don't need a degree in alcoholology or something to do this. And
yes, in alcoholism.
Anybody who makes alcohol understands this. And the taste difference is vast. If you distill within that proper temperature range, then the alcohol has a good mouthfeel to it. It's not really, really nasty. But if you get outside of that temperature range, you can taste the difference. And so if you're brewing something to sell, you want to brew something that's palatable and sellable. And if you're doing that and you're making something that is not palatable and will kill the people you're selling it to, you won't stay in business very long. But that rumor or that legend of poisoned alcohol actually came from the government intentionally poisoning the alcohol in order to give illegal alcohol a bad reputation. And this is not all that unusual. The United States government did the same thing with marijuana coming out of Mexico during the 1970s in the Paraquat scandal. Mm-hmm. They went into Mexico, used the political force of the United States government, and sprayed paraquat, which is a defoliant. It's very similar to Agent Orange, or what's that Monsanto stuff that everybody hates so bad? Roundup. It's kind of like that, but they sprayed paraquat on the marijuana fields in Mexico, and it killed the marijuana plants. Now, all these poor farmers in Mexico are barely making a living anyway. They're not the ones making the big money off of the marijuana. So if their crop is suddenly dead, what do they do with it? Well, they harvest it anyway. And so they harvested their crop and sent it to Southern California. And all this paraquat-laced marijuana is coming into Southern California, making people sick. And then the government's like, see, marijuana is bad for you. It will kill you. It will make you sick. No! It's not the plant that's doing it. It's you politicians and your stinking violence. That's where the problem is. That's, you know.
Well, they obviously think that they know better than we do.
I know. Yeah, what we're allowed to ingest.
What we're allowed to put in our bodies.
It's like before 2005 in the UK, they had this weird rule with like magic mushrooms. And the idea was if you had them like wet mushrooms, it was legal. But if they were dry, then they were considered illegal. Because
they were considered ready to consume at that point. It was a really dumb rule. But then they actually
just made it all illegal.
Mushrooms are classy drugs.
No, we're not even going to give you that anymore. We're just going to make these all illegal. Despite the fact that they grow freely everywhere around
in Scotland
you can't stop,
as well, there's a lot of mushrooms in the park, and I've heard there's some people in Glasgow that are psychonauts that go to the park and pick them and know what they're looking for. I don't trust anybody I know well enough to go and pick a mushroom for me to consume. No.
Let me tell you this: there's an older gentleman I know who knows a park.
Oh, and let's see, but Dan knows an older gentleman, and you can find out who he is after the break.
Freedom
I'm Fiend. Excited. I have no idea.
We'll be right Fiends. Back.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Freedom Fiends. Pouring truth down your ear hole. I almost said wormhole, but that's a different topic altogether.
In your wormhole.
Ear hole. Truth in your ear hole. So Dan, right before the break, Dan was about to tell us about some old guy.
His friend. Yeah. Tell us of your old friend.
Okay, so an older gentleman is an acquaintance of mine, just shall
that
we say.
Weird.
And okay. there's a park in this specific part of Glasgow, and he said for years, since like the 70s onwards, they used to go there, and there was loads of magic mushrooms used to just naturally grow there. A lot of people just didn't know what they were, but if you knew what you were looking for and you could get really good magic mushrooms there, then people eventually cottoned on to this, and like I think it was like the 80s, 90s, and then they actually told the local council, who are like the sort of local government, and then what did they do? They showed up with all these chemicals, they sprayed the entire park top to bottom, and apparently they've never grown there since.
Wow.
I weep. I kind of weep when I see stuff like that. I've watched a lot of documentaries that are about the war on drugs, and I've seen entire lovely crops of marijuana just destroyed and incinerated. It makes me sad, though. I don't see why they need to do that.
I guess this is probably...
It just makes me angry.
This is probably a good excuse for me to say something that I've been saying for probably 30 years. And that is that, you know, marijuana grows naturally almost everywhere in the world, not Antarctica, not the, you know, the Arctic cap area, but in most of the habitable places.
It needs to be pretty hot.
Yeah. In most of the habitable places of the earth, it will grow in one form or another. And I've said for years that
it is a weed.
It is. Yeah. And, somebody with some, horticultural experience should do some crossbreeding and make a version of it. It doesn't matter what the THC content is, but they need to make a version of it that will reseed itself very aggressively, and then just spread that stuff in every government, you know, every government park and every between highways and the roads.
Gorilla growing.
Yeah. And how can you have something illegal if it literally sprouts up everywhere that you're not mowing? Yeah. And that's how you peaceably defeat the war on drugs, is you make the thing so common that that the law becomes silly. Cody Wilson and I were talking about this with printing guns, and that's kind of his goal with using 3D printers is to find things that the government says no, you can't have that, and then make it so common that anybody can produce one in their office or garage or bedroom or whatever, and then your forbidding laws that your little government does out there, it means nothing, because if you can make it in your bedroom, what's the good of the law? And that's why we need more alcohol production, more marijuana, more guns.
Everybody, stop what you're doing and start making things. No. I was just going to say that is a thing here. Gorilla growing even happens in a country like Scotland. I don't do it personally because I don't really fancy going to jail or finding out how to do it. It sounds complicated, and I'm a very, very lazy person by nature. So I'm not going to do it. But it's a good idea, and gorilla growing does happen here. There are a few places that, you know, some people were doing it for a while, and just in our, like, for example, our local park even for a while apparently had a few crops growing, and it was just literally people who really were like, up the system, we can't be doing with this anymore. They went and got some seeds and just went and planted them, like you say, like beside motorways or, you know, in local parks, you know, in local, you know, wherever, just along the streets, you know.
You can tell sometimes when you look at, sometimes you look up at the windows and they're covered with things, but there's like a little fan coming out, and you kind of go,
Glasgow's a big city for that. It's a big thing here.
I've heard the theory that it's common.
I think it is. It's far more common than we think, but I think that can only be good for the war on drugs, because, you know, marijuana is one of those things. I view it like any other kind of intoxicant. I view it as too much of it will probably be a boo-boo for you. You need to know what you're consuming. You need to know where it's come from. You need to know, you know, the whole criminal aspect obviously just adds the whole thing of you don't know what you're consuming. You don't know if that's been sprayed with pesticide. You don't know who's made it. It could be made in a basement. It could be bad stuff. It also could be maybe a high sativa and you need a very strong indica. There's a lot of factors, and I would say Amsterdam's a great place. Dan and I went to the cannabis college. I asked a few questions and stuff. They're very, very helpful.
Yeah, and Amsterdam, someone will give you, like, because it's decriminalized, not legalized,
you'll
get a menu. with organic things in it.
Interesting.
And we're gonna have be back in hour two of the Freedom Fiends. So stick with us. Don't let the you're gonna hear news during this break. Don't let that upset you. We'll be back.
We'll be back with good news.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Antiwar, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
I have a feeling Michael's listening, right? He's not far away, right?
In some weird way. How is he
listening? You never know. You never know with Michael. No, I think he's probably asleep.
I don't know.
This time of the day, he's usually... Well, he doesn't do well during daytime.
Yeah.
He sent me an email once entitled, "I see you looking at the Fiend site."
Like, and we're like, whoa. And
he sent out the libertarian NSA. It's funny.
I know what you're doing. I see you.
That was basically the gist of the email.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Re-Education Center's low-orbit ion cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza, on the artificial satellite LibPair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. This allows reuse by anyone except for governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. My name is Dan Green. I'm here with the lovely Katie Green. Hello. And we're talking to Ben Stone. We've been talking about illegal substances, haven't we?
Yes. In some bizarre turnaround conversation.
And all kinds of other crazy things, too. Animals knocking over trash cans. That's, you know, you were saying in the first hour that foxes... behave like that. That's amazing, because the foxes here in the U.S. that I've encountered are extremely shy. Out west, they have a thing called a kit fox, which is a tiny little fox about the size of a chihuahua with giant ears. And they are unbelievably cute, really shy. And if you get anywhere near them, they move like lightning, and they will bite you like 40 times and run away. And then you realize that they may not have even broke the skin when they bit you, but they're really shy, cute little animals. But here in the eastern United States, we have full-size foxes with the big fuzzy tails, and you know.
The ones we have. Yeah,
you almost never see them. You can hear them in Appalachia. I used to lay at night and listen for the foxes, because they sound in the distance like somewhere between a baby screaming and a very angry woman screaming. And you can hear it. It's kind of unnerving when you're not expecting it.
Really, I know the exact sound you mean.
Yeah.
I actually know the exact sound you mean.
We hear it in the alleyway behind us.
It's so unnerving, because you're not sure if it's like a child or not. It's so strange. It's such a weird kind of sound, a fox screaming like that. It really is unnerving.
It's awful, actually. It really upsets. It's quite distressing to hear that at 3 o'clock in the morning. But foxes are incredibly common here.
We were talking about mushrooms earlier,
the magic variety.
Yeah, in the first hour, and Katie and I saw it was a part of a documentary series about drugs. And what was interesting was this guy who had cluster headaches, and apparently these are some kind of cluster migraines or something like that.
These are
the worst kind of headaches you can get. And he said he was going to kill himself, but one time he tried magic mushrooms. And now the odd thing is, he hated the magic mushrooms. He hated the tripping experience. But for months after, he didn't get these headaches.
He said the headaches were so bad he was going to
kill himself. Like, that's how bad they were. Yeah. So he started growing them in his house. And like, they filmed him, and he said, like, I hate this. He said, I hate tripping.
He lives in the UK too, and they're a class A drug here.
Yeah.
So he actually faces heavy, heavy prosecution if he's ever caught. That. It was an American documentary.
But he said it's the only thing that makes him like stay alive, basically, because he'll maybe trip, say, once, and then for like maybe 4 or 5 months, he's fine. But then the headaches will come back, and then he has to take a dose again.
I can't remember what that documentary was called. I really wish I did, though. I wish I remembered it, but I only remember that bit.
That episode, yeah. It was really interesting because it's not like he was doing it for pleasure.
Well, the thing is, it's such a controversial subject, especially in the UK, Class B drug, which means that the UK government do not recognize any medicinal value in it whatsoever, which is something that Dan and I disagree with. There's been enough evidence now. I mean, I'm not going to name them all. I'm just saying there's been enough studies done and tests shown it's available for medicinal use in so many places now, in Canada, the US, even in Europe, I think they're starting to play around with that. I think somebody mentioned that to me the other night. But I need to get my facts straight. No, but Amsterdam's a grey area of decriminalisation. But it does show you, and Amsterdam's just up the road from us. You know, it's an hour flight, but it's not. It's had no bearing on the law here. So, but the UK is never far behind the US in terms of trends and things that we're going to do. So, I mean, specifically, usually politically. The US is where everything kind of happens, and then the UK go, I want to do that too. And they just do it too. That's how I sort of see it. So,
you know, it's, I don't know. Do you guys know that I have cluster headaches? Did you already know that?
No,
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. That's weird.
I had a concussion. Well, I've had over 35 concussions, and I had a concussion in, I think it was 2002. Which was a fairly mild concussion, but it was kind of the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. And that concussion, within about 6 months, I spiraled into a pattern where I was having waves of cluster headaches every night, and then migraine headaches during the day. And it's indescribable. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time today on the radio talking about it, but to give you an idea of what a cluster headache is like, for me, they hit in 15-minute cycles, and you could almost set a clock to them. They were so accurate. They would, about 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning, they would come on and wake me up, and they would go for 15 minutes on and then 15 minutes off, and it would be anywhere from 1 to like 5 or 6 cycles like this of on and off in 15-minute cycles. And I actually broke most of my molar teeth off during the first few months of this happening. And the way it would happen is I would be asleep, the cluster headache would hit,
grind.
And I would clamp my teeth down so hard I would snap off a molar.
Gosh!
And sometimes, I learned within a few months, I learned that what I had to do was sleep with a mouth guard, a sports mouth guard. Mm. In my mouth when I slept, in order so that when that cluster headache hit, I wouldn't break my teeth off. But as of today, I don't have any intact molars because of that. But the headaches were unbelievable. I would have to, in order to not disturb my wife, I would sort of fall out of bed to the ground, sort of crawl and make my way into the other room. And just, I would be on my hands and knees with my head against the floor, just doing everything within my power to not kill myself to end the pain because it hurts so bad. And oftentimes I wouldn't even notice the broken tooth until I would find it laying, you know, in my bed or in the floor, or I would find it with my tongue after the headache was over with. I'd realize, oh man, I broke another tooth. But the pain of the headache was so intense that I wouldn't even notice breaking the tooth off. And so this was going on. It went on every night for about a year and a half. And the doctors had me on all kinds of medications trying to overcome it, including real high levels of morphine. I was taking a drug called Cadian. Cadian, I think. Cadian. Anyway.
It's like my name.
Yeah. It's a high level of time-release morphine that they usually only give to cancer victims that they know are not going to live because it's so addictive. I'm sure there's somebody out there who knows a medication that's saying, no, they give it to this also or whatever. But
Katie works in a pharmacy.
Actually. Katie's I know exactly what you're talking about.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I know what it is. It's like, it's called MST here. It's sustained release morphine.
Yeah, yeah.
You take one every like 12 hours or something. No, and they usually do just give that to palliative care patients that they know are dying soon. So so to get that for headaches, I can tell that it was genuinely like hardcore, because that in the UK that would never be prescribed for any kind of headaches. That's like, especially but that sounds awful. I mean, It amazes me that doctors here and pharmacists here still recommend paracetamol or Tylenol, as you might know it, because it's so harsh on your liver.
Yeah.
And I hear it being, it's the most prescribed painkiller ever.
Wow.
And they give it to cancer patients here too, and it wrecks your liver. It's awful on your liver. Like, and obviously if you have any kind of hepatic damage done already, if anybody takes those painkillers, I always give them in trouble.
Yeah.
Don't take them. They're so bad for you. But there's so many natural things that people can do for stuff. But it's just sad. I just, you know, I don't mean to talk about it too much. I've been thinking about it a lot over the last few days, you know. Just natural remedies that are totally just shoved off as complete nonsense.
I would have.
When they have a lot of benefits.
I would have taken, I would have done almost anything to overcome mm-hmm. those headaches back in the day. And the morphine that they had mm-hmm. me on, it didn't touch the headaches. It would, what the morphine would do for me is it would allow me to sleep, you know, at off times, so that I could get a good night's sleep during the break when I wasn't having a headache. But when the actual headache hit, mm-hmm. I couldn't, you know, the morphine was nothing more than an aspirin for me. It didn't even take the edge off in the slightest way. It was, the headaches were that bad. There are people, actually, I've kind of studied this a little bit because I was interested back then. This was 2002, 2003, in that range. And there are quite a number of cases. Sometimes cluster headaches are called suicide headaches because it's relatively common for the person who is suffering them to just get to the point of where they have no hope and they kill themselves. Mm. And they do it in odd ways. Like, they'll find somebody in their garage with a drill and like 14 holes drilled in their head, or with a skill saw, you know, a handheld power saw, and they'll cut the top of their skull off or something like this. And oftentimes,
just to make it stop.
Yeah, because you get delusional with that level of pain. You get really weird things come into your mind that, you know, because it feels, it literally feels like your head's exploding. It feels like your eyes are going to pop right out of their sockets. And it feels like the top of your head is just going to, at any moment, the skull is going to crack and your brains are just going to go flying out. It hurts in that way. And so I can see why, you know, it would drive a person completely insane. And the fear of knowing that it's going to come on tonight, when I go to sleep, it's going to hit. The anticipation of that will cause a person to not go to sleep, because you just sit in anticipation of this pain. And so then you don't sleep, and then you get into a pattern of not getting enough rest, and then that makes the headaches worse. Mm-hmm. So I can really see why, you know, a person would do that. It was one of those kill you or cure you type of a thing, where I learned that I'm not magical or have powers that no one else has or anything like that. But I learned that I can take anything if I know that it will come to an end at some point. So, government, you know, you can't torture me and get anything out of me.
This man can go through that. He can take you. It's fine.
That's a challenge.
You don't scare him.
Come and get me. Take me to Guantanamo. We'll be right back after this little trip to the market.
For some reason in this country, and in a bunch of lesser world, it's okay to just dodge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created FiendPhone. I'm using FiendPhone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to fiendphone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's fiendphone.com, F-E-E-N-P-H-O-N-E.com. Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, phone.com.
Fiendphone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
It's really nice because one of the reasons why I enjoy this is I just like talking to people. I do it, you know, I do it in my job and I do it everywhere, you know, it's a thing. I don't know. I really enjoy this. Like, where else would I get to talk to someone at the other end of the frickin' earth? You know what I mean? Like, it's amazing though. It's quite fantastic. I really enjoy it. It's really, really good fun.
We're about to come back. Are you guys ready to go?
Do, 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 do. Yeah. Dan, are you ready?
Yep.
Barney, are you ready?
Freedom Fiends. So much truth it hurts. But not like a headache.
No. That's worse than anything ever. That is just going to stay with me.
See, I've been one of those guys that I never get headaches. Like, as much as I've drank, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, but like, I've never really been like, every time I've had a hangover, I never get a headache with it. Headaches are extremely rare for me. I know something's really wrong if I get it.
Yeah. I had one once behind my eye, and that was I had to wear like an ice patch thing. I was actually babysitting for children at that time, and I remember going, "Does your mummy or daddy ever get a headache?" And they went, "Yeah." And I went, "What does mummy do?" And they went and took me to the freezer and they pulled out this ice pack and I went, "Thank you." And I stuck it on my face. That I wasn't hung over anything. No, Dan's looking at me like, "This is terrible." So no, funny. I was babysitting.
It's like
kids.
The plot of like an 80s movie.
Yeah.
Almost like, all right.
Don't tell mum the babysitter's got a cluster headache and it's like me and I'm like, okay, kids.
I know it wouldn't be as much fun, right? But I'm saying it could be a small part.
No, it was incredibly dull. The child showed me where the ice pack was. I put it on my face. I lay down. They played, the headache went away, and I got paid, and I went home, and it was great.
That story.
I was at 16 when that happened. Yeah,
that story could go in a different direction. What does your mom do for a headache? Well, she has over in this cabinet. Here's this special thing.
She has some wine. You could get really, really drunk and take care of us. I go, okay. No. Babysitting was is a great another example that I really like of kind of free market childcare stuff.
Well, actually, Murray Rothbard used babysitting as an example of like how child nurseries care. You don't have to have all government regulations to start a nursery. That's why nurseries for children are so expensive. He just pointed to, you know, teenage girls babysitting. Like, you did that and you made a lot of money doing that.
I made tons.
You don't have to go through health and safety, you know, seminars to do it. You know what I mean?
Like my mom, I was really, really lucky because my mom's side of the family is a little bit wealthier than usual, and they knew a lot of people that were like wealthy and maybe had quite a lot of children. So I was really lucky, and through when I was about 16 through to, well, actually I was about 15 through to probably 18, 19, I made a lot of money, and then they decided, I think, their kids actually just grew up enough that they were just old enough to take care of themselves, and that was it. So, but that was a really, really great time, and I would hope that babysitting's something that, like, I've told my sister to try and get in there. But it's different now, apparently. I think people want people with qualifications, you know?
You know, it's
but
a funny thing, though. Even now, a lot of people still just trust a neighborhood kid to babysit or whatever. A lot of it...
I like that.
Local governments are trying to outlaw that from happening in the U.S. But still...
It's awful.
I think a lot of it takes place. Local daycare centers where it's just a woman who has one or two kids, and she also watches three or four kids for friends while they're at work or whatever... And that's all across the U.S. It takes place. And nobody thinks a thing about it. But yet, in the first hour, we were talking about how if you talk about home production of alcohol, somebody might immediately say, oh, you can't do that. You'll end up, you know, poisoning someone. Or you wouldn't want to drink alcohol that you just bought from some guy because it might be poisoned. And, and yet, you'll take your kids over to a 17-year-old and have a 17-year-old watch your kids, but you won't buy alcohol from that kid's parent because he might poison it. I mean, you know, if you'll trust your kids to the market, and it's not just that, it's like everything you buy, you're trusting. Every purchase is a trust in the market.
Yeah.
And it has been for as long as there's been humans, you know, as long as these things that we call humans have actually had human characteristics, we've been sociable with one another, and there's been a market. And it works. It's the one thing that we know absolutely always works. And that's the essence of anarchy. The market is anarchy in you know, in its practical outworking. And so many people are afraid, oh, anarchy, that's where there's no government regulations to control us and keep us safe. Exactly. Anarchy is what provides childcare that's safe and reliable, and every tomato you eat that you get from some local grower or whatever, that's the beauty of it. It has no, there's no, you know, there's no coercion, there's no force, there's no regulation that can actually
There's
make
no
it
agenda
safe.
Behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nobody has an agenda. Everybody just wants to live peacefully at the end of the day, you know?
I've said it a lot of times, and it's kind of a relative example for here. Like, there's been, like, spates of bad ecstasy that have, like, come into, like, the city, into nightclubs, and a bunch of people have died.
And even more on the drug
But whereas if that was legal, can you imagine if it was a company that everyone knew that was supplying the ecstasy and it killed people? They would be out of business so fast.
Yeah.
So buy your ecstasy from people you know, kids.
Yeah.
That's the lesson here.
Off to the market we go.
Woo!
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, you didn't build that? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
That's weird.
Alphas and omegas on one side. Now we sound that really fast.
I like the cat.
So busy talking, we can't do a talk show.
I have too much to say to do this.
So Dan was telling us in the break about his tattoo. Go ahead, Dan, finish your thought.
Go on, Dan.
My very thoughts. No, I've got a tattoo of, and it's like an alpha and an omega, and like sort of, you know, Greek script. And it was because I always remember, like, I grew up like sort of Catholic, and I always remembered that bit in the book of Revelation, you know, and I think there's other references to it as well, when God says I am the Alpha and the Omega, because I got interested because I used to see a lot of Catholic priests that wore things that had an Alpha on one side and an Omega on the other, and I was always kind of fascinated by that. And then I found out it was because it's the first and last letters of the alphabet.
Yeah.
So what everything. He means is I am the first and the last, I am everything. Yeah. And I always thought that that was a really cool thing. That's the one of the parts of the Bible that I always really
like. It's cool.
Liked.
It's a good tattoo. I enjoy the tattoo.
Do you have any tattoos?
I've never really thought too much. Oh, I'm covered in tattoos.
Really?
I
don't
enjoy
get started.
Oh. Yeah, I have quite a few, but I don't know. I don't really put them too much in show. I guess the ones on my forearms and the one on my chest are always visible when I'm at work and stuff, but I have a few other ones, but they're quite secretive.
Is that socially acceptable in Scotland?
It's getting a lot more popular here. Everybody's got a tattoo. Everybody.
What time a taxi driver was saying to Katie, because she's got all these tattoos.
Yeah. Can I just tell you this, right? I phoned a taxi one day. It's a little private taxi company. So just guys in their cars with the little things, the radios that they buy from company. So this guy was driving me one day, and he went, you know, I wouldn't hire you with all of those tattoos. And I felt like going, you're a taxi driver. You drive a car for a living, and you're telling me if you
it's
were hiring
well, you're
me,
not interviewing me
to be what, your taxi driving assistant, you wouldn't hire me because of the ink on my skin. Are you kidding me? But I just went, oh, yeah, well, they're not for everyone, you know. And the guy was just like, I don't mean any offense. And I was like, no, offense has already been had, sir. I did not tip him that day.
Well, I've heard depictions of the Celts of being tattooed and naked, you know, and all this kind of thing.
I'm not naked,
and then tattooing
yes.
goes back in, you know, places like Japan, Hawaii, and stuff like that. And then also, we have our ears stretched. We have like sort of holes in our ears.
But that, I like
again,
that
goes back.
Really,
so when people say you kids doing these things, these traditions go way further
these
back.
These are really old traditions.
Yeah,
like
they go way further back.
I remember when I was thinking about stretching my ears. I always remember when I was young, we did a study on Africa, and we did some studies on some of the traditions of the people, and I remember it was this woman had a plate in her lip, And it was just crazy. And this was considered a sign of like attraction. This was considered like an attractive thing. If you had a woman with a large plate, you know, the woman could take it, you know, she could take pain, she could do it. And I just, I always remember thinking, what a strong person. Why are you laughing at me, sir? Oh, I don't think this is inaccurate. I remember thinking when I was very young, wow, that must have hurt, like, to do that. But then I did it, and I know it didn't hurt that much, you know. It's a very feminine thing. Why are you looking at me so oddly, Dan? He's looking at me like I've just told him that I'm pregnant or something. Like, he's acting like this is horrific. No, do you not have a view on that, Dan?
It's just the way you described it.
Was it a bit strange?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I sometimes like to describe things a bit sort of unusually, but no, I always remember that from when I was a little girl. So I'm just saying that was sort of why I decided to stretch my ears.
I had a weird experience.
And I thought it looked cool. So, yeah.
I had a weird experience with tattoos when I was young. And, you know, I think if you are in the age group between, say, 16 and 25, 26, if you don't get any tattoos in that age, you probably are not going to get any unless you have a midlife crisis and you want to renew your youth and look, you know, look hipster or whatever. But the very first time, not my first encounter with police, but the first time I actually got taken into a police office, you know, and questioned and photographed and all that kind of thing. Me and another guy, were hauled into the police station, and we were, you know, questioned about all our horrible activity that we were involved in. And they made us take our shirts off because they wanted to look for gang symbols in tattoos. And the guy that was with me, he had several tattoos, and they photographed them. They forced him to stand in different positions so that they could get the lighting right, and they photographed all his tattoos. And I didn't have any tattoos, and I thought that it just kind of weirded me out that the government keeps track of, and I was like, at that time, I think I was about 17. I was either 16 or 17, and it weirded me out that the government keeps track of your tattoos. And I thought, that's it. I'll never get a tattoo because I won't, you know, it's like, I won't give them the satisfaction of that. And I kind of, you know, it's kind of a silly thing, but all my friends, like I rode motorcycles with the bikers and everybody had tattoos. And I was kind of the freak that didn't have any tattoos. And the only thing, I never really liked needles, but it wasn't that so much that I just couldn't stand the thought of giving satisfaction to a cop, of having him classify me and, you know, hold me down and take a picture of my tattoo or whatever. It just infuriated me to the point of where I was like, I'm not going to give him that satisfaction. I'm not going to. And then later, I kind of, an aspect of my appearance now, I've said this a few times, that if I ever need to, you know, with a razor and a pair of scissors, I can modify my appearance so drastically that I could walk down the street and my own children wouldn't recognize me within about 10 minutes. So I've always kind of had that in the background, that fascination of being able to evaporate and become whatever I need to be, you know. And I've always felt like tattoos would prevent me from doing that. I know that's probably nonsensical. It's probably the worst logical argument you could come up with.
No, I think that's actually interesting. And, you know, Dan, if I ever come home with dyed brown hair, a turtleneck, and with just two holes in my ears, you'll know I'm on the run because that's the only way, you know. Long sleeve turtleneck.
That's probably the only way. Yeah. I mean, Katie's hair is just now, what would you call it?
Oh, my hair is purple. Magenta.
Magenta or
that's
purple
a color.
To
that's
anyone
a female
who's not a
made
woman.
Color.
You women keep making up colors pink. That aren't real, right? There's only several colors. You can't keep
in
making
man,
other ones
speak,
up. It's just not
magenta
right.
Magenta is pink. It's like a pinky purple. But you'll know I'm on the lam if, you know, I come home just with like brown hair and like a turtleneck with long
that's
sleeves.
That's how I know something has gone terribly wrong.
Something has gone wrong. What have you done with my wife? So you'll know.
This kind of takes us back to the natural disaster thing in that I talked about in the first hour.
Yes.
In 1966, I was in Kalinga, California, when a really bad earthquake hit. And the only aftermath of that, the only way that it changed, you know, my life or anything like that, my dad came home the same year, I should mention, the same year my my cousin, who I was 5 years old, but my cousin was an adult. He was close to 30 or so. He was flying in a private airplane and crashed in the Sierra Nevada mountains and was lost for like 3 or 4 days before he walked out of there and made it down to a road where he could get a ride and be found. And these two events took place the same year. And from that, the lesson that my dad took from it was that we all need to have what my dad called a flight bag. And he meant that in two ways. A flight bag, meaning if you take a flight in an airplane, you should have a bag that has everything you need in one bag, and you should have it with you so that if all else is lost, you have that one bag with your primary, one change of clothes and your primary things that you're going to need to survive. But he also meant it as a flight bag, as in, if things turn bad, you grab that bag and you fly. You get out of there. You take flight. So in 1966, I made my first flight bag. And nowadays, the kids call those bug-out bags. But
bug-out bag.
I have had a flight bag since 1966, packed and ready to go, and usually stashed someplace where it's not obvious, or in the trunk of the car or whatever like that. It's just one of the things that I've done. There was a slight gap in time when I didn't have one for a while, so I shouldn't say I've always had one, but there was a gap when I didn't have one. But that's always kind of been that thing. If natural disasters have twisted me in any way, that would be it, that I have always maintained the thought that at any particular time, I may need to just grab this bag and vanish.
Yeah, that's something we've been thinking about.
You've been thinking about it, Dan. I don't really, I'm one of these people. I don't know. I'm not too concerned.
The thing is, we live in a very non-conspicuous sort of flat, and we're up the stairs, and we have
we're
a door.
Very,
our
very
door's
well
unkickinable because there's actually what we found out one time when our lock broke. What we found out, courtesy of a locksmith, was there's a big steel door, basically. So the way you would kick it in through the wood
to get through the door.
Yeah, it would take an awful lot to kick through that big steel plate that's behind.
It's totally nobody's getting through there because these are really, really old buildings, and they reinforced all the doors a few years ago. So we actually found out because one time we locked ourselves out. We called a locksmith, and he was like, "Nope, nobody's getting through that, baby. You have
to
know."
Yeah, because we tried to kick it in.
We actually tried. Everybody tried.
Me and a few other people had tried to kick it in, and it was not happening.
That was quite heroic of you that day. You were like, "No, I'll do it." It was very gentlemanly of you, but no, nobody's getting through there. So
no.
So we're just going to stay here at the end of the world. So
that's the idea. We've got enough canned goods to keep us going for a while.
Yeah, we've got enough food.
So, but I know what you mean. But I've actually thought having a bucket bag would probably be a good thing to have just in case, because you do never know. I mean, you never know. It could be, the thing that you need it for could happen in 100 years.
It could happen it could happen tomorrow. It could happen in 1,000 years. I don't know.
I guess it kind of has led to the lifestyle that I live now, on the road, in the RV, moving around, staying mobile, not really getting close to any people, not in physical contact, but in, not emotionally getting connected to people where we travel. We just kind of float in, hang around for a while, move on to the next campground, and sort of the nomadic lifestyle. I get a lot of comfort out of that. It feels better not always knowing that I could be gone tomorrow. We could just pack up everything and be three states away within a few hours the next day. That I just find a lot of comfort in that. I don't know.
I think I'm kind of the same, and I think I'm the type of person that changes things up every few months. I get a little bit antsy, maybe change the furniture in the room or. Do you know, change the hair or change something? I think they're...
Darling, decorating is a living art. It's a living, breathing art. It's vibrant. It's moving forward.
Stop doing that. Talk to me through the radio.
Stick with us, folks. We'll be right back with Redemption in the Third Act.
Ooh.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Dan, you're weird.
LRN.FM needs your help getting our satellite signal back on in Africa. Our satellite provider had us on at no charge from 2012 through February of this year when they pulled the channel off the air. Now we're trying to raise $22,000 to continue reaching people with the message of liberty in places where it's needed most. Please visit our Indiegogo fundraiser at africa.lrn.fm. Give what you can and share the link with your friends. africa.lrn.fm.
I don't think my boss would take too kindly to it.
Bosses never understand that kind of thing.
Nah.
Freedom Fiends. And we're going to try to wrap this up here. We've been on almost 2 hours on the radio with me, Ben Stone, and Dan and Katie Green from wonderful Scotland. It's one of the places I've always wanted to visit is Scotland.
Bonnie Scotland.
My brother, there's very few things you can say that, that cause my brain to go into negative convulsions. But one of the thing one of the things you can say is like government, 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 and I'll go yarr. But one of the things is to mention my brother because he irritates me so bad. But my brother has traveled around the world with his job. Literally, he's been around the world like, I don't know, 10 or 15 times. And he travels a lot. And the first time that he was in Scotland and he came back and I went over to talk to him and I was like, dude, so, you know, I knew that he was in Edinburgh. That was the thing. I knew that he had spent like 2 weeks in Edinburgh. And so I go over to his house and I'm like, so, you know, did you go up and see the castle? Did you see the stone? Did you see the... And he's like, what? There's a castle in Edinburgh? And I was like, you dunderhead. How do you not know that?
It's right there.
Yeah. It's like, the, it's on the,
you
the
really
hill.
You really can't
is,
miss it.
Yeah. How do you not see the castle from anywhere? Do you just, you land at the you airport, keep your nose against, you know, how do you do that? How do you not know there's a castle in Edinburgh? And how are you in Scotland and not go, where's a castle? I mean, to me, like, if you land anywhere in the British Isles, the first thing I'm going to want to do is find the nearest castle. I mean, why would you not? That's what you do. You're, you know, thousands of years our people have lived in on these islands, and you don't go see the castle. I wanted to smack him in the head.
But, what did he go see? Did he say?
He just went.
Did
from,
he say what he actually did? Did he waste his time?
Well, he went from the airport to his hotel, and from his hotel to the test cells for General Electric, where he worked at, and then spent the days at the test cells, and then went back to his hotel, and then, you know, ordered in to his room to eat. Didn't even go out to eat. 2 weeks, and that was his entire life in Scotland, going back and forth from work. And in, this included he had days off, and his days off he spent in the hotel room looking at the television. Now, that alone, you know, I want to throw rocks at him just for that. But he did the same thing in Moscow. He spent like a week in Moscow and never went over and saw the Kremlin. How do you go to Moscow and not see the Kremlin? How do you do that? He was in Paris, didn't go to the Louvre.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, man. Come on. Even I did that.
When I went to Paris, I was only like 12 when I went, but I even knew.
It's
I was like
if you go to Amsterdam and you don't go to the Sex Museum.
Yeah, that's like going to Amsterdam and not going to the red light district. Why would you not?
You know, if I
booked us a hotel there by accident and it was brilliant.
If I ever
actually
made it,
found the best hotel in Amsterdam.
Ever.
If I ever made it to Europe, pretty much anywhere in Europe, I would, if I had to crawl on my hands and knees, there are a few things I would see. Mm. And one of those things would be the Alhambra in Spain. And I would have to see the Greek ruins. I would have to go and see some of the Italian ruins in the different cities. And I would have to go to Scotland. And I would have, there's probably, I'm going to say there's going to be 5 castles that I would have to see in the British Isles. And at least 2 of them are in Scotland. And I would, you know, do whatever I had to do to get to Germany and see a couple of the castles there, too. And I don't know, maybe it's silly on my part, but I have always loved architecture and especially the really old stuff like that.
Oh, no, I think Dan and I can certainly appreciate that. One of my favorite things in Amsterdam is the architecture. And I think that might be a nice thing to sort of almost end on the show, is this idea of this art that is that stays with us.
Yeah,
I have a castle question.
Living art, you know. Castle question, Dan?
Ben, was one of your castles on your list Blarney Castle in Ireland?
Yes, actually.
Most of the Blarney Stone.
Dan's psychic.
You get the gift of the gab.
Some would say I already have
too much.
Ben, this has been fantastic. I don't really want this to end.
It's been really wonderful talking to you guys today. It's awesome. I have really enjoyed this.
I've enjoyed that.
I very much enjoyed it.
I just enjoy hearing your voices, both of you. It feels so right.
Oh, thank you. Oh, awesome. Worms.
Worms.